You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, I'm going to give you my James Lipton question. Charles Bukowski said, find what you love and let it kill you. How does that make you feel?
You know what? I think it's too much on this find what you love thing. Find what you're good at, right? Because if you're good at it, you will love it, all right? Because here's the problem with find what you love, okay? If I had my way, I would have been the next Steve Howe, okay? I didn't have anywhere near the talent to become the next Steve Howe or anybody like him, okay? So find your love is a stupid piece of advice if you're not fucking wired to do what you love. And what if you're only a teenager and, you know, you love, you know, I could go on about all the different examples, right? But if you can find what you're good at, it's kind of fun to be good at something, you know, and people will pay you for it and you get accolades and promotions and shit like that. It's just like, oh, I kind of like being good at things, you know?
Hi, I'm Ben Goodman. And you're listening to 2020. And if you haven't figured out by now, my compatriots are Corey Pazza and Siobhan Cronin.
That's us.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Can you see me? It's so dark here.
Even a week later, still didn't fix it after a week, Siobhan. It's crazy.
Yeah. Like, what the hell? Get on that shit. Like, what kind of girl doesn't have, like, a selfie light?
It's time for a new
one,
guys.
You need to get your priorities straight, girl.
Apparently.
Shit. Coconut oil. Solves all the problems. But this week, the guy solving all of my mental problems, wondering what the hell's going on with all the retail landscape after the COVIDs. We have G. Jolly, who also proclaims that there's going to be a civil war, which, to be honest with you, with the winds outside, I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah, this was a pretty wild episode. We went a little off the rails and talked about some interesting things. So
some eclectic topics, for sure.
Right.
So check it out, part two with Gene Jolly. Hello and welcome to another episode of 2020. We are so happy to welcome back our guest, Mr. Gene Jolly. Old industry dog was the way you described yourself in the first episode.
68. I think I earned the title of old industry dog.
Well, you certainly don't talk like an old industry dog in the best of ways. You have a lot of amazing stories and super sharp. I mean, your memory is incredible, though. I sent a message to Ben and Corey over the break, and I was like, wow. It's amazing. I feel like you recall stuff with so much accuracy, way beyond like what my brain can even handle. But,
some things. Don't get me down one of those alleys real quick. I know it's on the tip of my tongue, you know. So annoying. It gets worse.
But anyway, in part one, for anyone that, you know, hasn't listened to that yet, get on it. Go check it out. Part one. We got into a lot of Gene's background, talking about merchandising. We talked about the Beatles. We talked about everything. Can't even describe it in one sentence. But, you know, one thing we started talking about on the, you know, speaking of musicians and releasing music is kind of this saturation of songs being out there, and you were talking about how people might only listen one or two times to a certain song. Then, you know, the discussion of is there still good music being produced. I wanted to talk a little bit about market saturation. Maybe it's not the right term, but, you know, what does it look like when, you know, you're at Guitar Center and there are other companies like Sweetwater or Sam Ash or other, you know, retailers that are doing kind of in a similar space.
eBay, Reverb.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear how you handle that when, you know, there are all these other retailers popping up. What does it look like at a place like Guitar Center, you know, dealing with that competition?
Yeah, I think the key is figure out what you can excel at and then just double down on doing that. Don't try to be everybody else. Sweetwater has one retail store in Fort Wayne where they're headquartered. It's an amazing store. All right. They do a killer job there and all that. I know the management there and know, we talked like any plans to retail, like we do this store because we have a local clientele. They drive from hundreds of miles away and all that, but we do what we do. This is our singular focus. If you go back to the late 70s when Chuck had a recording band and people wanted to buy it, they loved his service and wanted to start buying stuff from him, he just basically started selling products and just, you know, built a mail order business with phones and catalogs and eventually a website and all that. And just, you know, 40 plus years just consistently continued to grow his concept and improve his concept. Didn't go off in a million different directions and, you know, built one of the most successful companies in the history of the music products industry. And just basically just, you know, sold his shares recently for, you know, quite a bit of money. But he, this gets back to the strategic thing. Sam Ash family has owned, started Sam Ash Music in the 1920s. So they're approaching
their
100th anniversary, primarily a retailer. They do some e-commerce, but primarily a retailer. They've been about 50 stores, primarily the East Coast and the West Coast, some stores in between. But they've got a very successful formula. It's a family-run business. Ash is still working the business, and they're very good at it. They're really good stores, highly respected, and shopped in the markets where they exist. GC's ambition was always to be the coast-to-coast retail. In the early days, the folks who really built the business after the founder, that was their vision, and it was very difficult. You know, they weren't professional retailers. They didn't know what the hell to do, but they pushed and they brought people in and they kept trying. So GC's cornerstone is the stores, but they've gotten very good at e-commerce, and as a result of having support e-commerce, they've got contact center, and that also supports the stores as well. So they're really the omni-channel giant where they cover all those bases. And then I love going to the country and walking into an indie store. It's run by an owner-operator who's got the lights on. Manchester Music Mill up in Manchester, New Hampshire. I just never even walked in there until recently. And
Joe Lacerda.
Joe Lacerda. Joe met Joe. A good friend of mine died in May. And his widow was left with a broken heart and a lot of music gear. And you know, we helped her out, sell some of it, but realized that the rate it was going was going to take 11 years, which she didn't have. Somebody suggested I call Joe, and Joe came down and spent a few hours and gave her a very fair deal and hauled it all away and all that. So he's built this incredible indie store up in Manchester. And there's stores like that all over the country. So they're all completely different business models. Don't try to be something you're not wired to do. And you don't have the resources to do. Find your niche and do it really, really well. So that's the success formula is find your thing and commit to it and really, really, and really stay true to that. And when you try to be what you're not, or you're all over the place, unlikely to work.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And that obviously applies to just about anything, whether it's retail or music or, you know. But yeah, I always wondered that because, like Ben mentioned in, you know, one of the previous episodes, having gone into Guitar Center, sometimes you see there's not a lot of stock on the wall or something, and you're wondering what's going on. And then another store's got a lot of stock. So I always wonder, you know, how the different, you know, other businesses interact and how it affects what goes on at Guitar Center or Sam Ash or Sweetwater's. Because, you know, to a lot of us, you know, the people that are buying the product, it's hard to know, you know, what how those things actually work behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the biggest problem keeping guitars on the wall right now is sales are vastly higher than supply. Demand is vastly higher. So that's you've heard all these stories about containers off the port of LA and not getting unloaded fast enough. It's affecting many businesses, including the guitar business.
How about the ukuleles? What's up with the ukulele? Everyone in the freaking world wants a freaking ukulele. In fact, I believe it's the number one instrument on the planet, so it's not a recorder anymore. I know people in the
Can
music
you stop saying
retail.
Ukulele, please?
I know people that sell ukes. that say that in the last like year or 2 years, they've sold more Ukes than like 30 years combined. Joe Lacerda, I'm sure, being one of them. Yeah. Why?
It's a female.
Why the Uke?
It's so simple. All right. It's cheap. It's portable. And it's easy to play. So my 14-year-old granddaughter, who I'm giving guitar lessons to, started on the Uke, just went on YouTube, got a Uke, went on YouTube, started figuring it out. And before you know it, she's playing songs on the Uke. Okay? She required no help, just a something that was very easy for her small hands to handle. I can take it around with me on family trips and so forth. So it's just like, it's super accessible, $100, easy to play, and highly portable. It's a the perfect instrument for getting started. Now, why it took all the years it did to become as popular as it is beyond me, because it's always been there. It always had this potential. And there's a lot of, I've heard a lot of hypotheses on why it suddenly took off. But I remember when Paul McCartney played something on the ukulele in the concert for George, I think it was 04, so 17 years ago. There was an instant huge spike in ukulele sales, right? But that was just one thing.
That's the Beatles thing.
It was a Beatle, right? So not to be discounted, right? Then it was this Jake, whoever's face is, the Hawaiian guy, or Chinese guy, phenomenal.
The dude who does Over the Rainbow?
No, that's a different guy. No. This is the virtual guy. Right? This guy, the Nuno of ukulele, right? So that guy got a bunch of other people interested. It seemed to like just things started feeding on each other, and now it's got this momentum because there's this whole thing in retail and manufacturing. The more something that's out there, the more momentum it creates for other people to jump on it, right? When you launch a product, you want to get units out into the field because other people are going to go, where'd you get that, right? And then there's this whole knock-on effect that happens. So something happened with Ukes for the reach critical mass, and it's pretty unstoppable right now. But I think the fundamentals are that it's inexpensive, portable, and easy to play. Four strings, not six. So you can get your head around that pretty quickly. And by the way, my granddaughter, who's progressing rapidly on guitar, she developed, you know, the hand, like her hands were used to all the stuff there. So it was a very easy transition to guitar for her.
Yeah, that's amazing. Let me ask, so kind of going back to merchandising or, you know, working in retail and deciding what products to sell or carry, you know, as being a lot of people that aren't, you know, actively, you know, playing music all the time, let's say, how do you stay in touch with what musicians want or what is going to be successful? I'm just curious how you figure that out, you know, because for me, I'm playing music all the time. I know what I want. But maybe if I worked in industry, it might be a little different. So how do you stay in tune with that?
Well, in retail, it's fairly easy because you've got the stores. These are all active musicians. Think of like a trader on the floor of the stock exchange. Like they're in the nerve center of all the action, right? A salesperson on the floor. I mean, to the point where manufacturers are going around, going to the stores all the time, you know, picking the brains of the floor staff because they're talking to customers all the time. They get the phone calls. They have their finger on the pulse. So you've got active musicians talking to other active musicians, and they're a great source of information. The manufacturers are a great source of information. They're doing their research and so forth. And the merchants, it's their job to know. So they're following the industry trade publications. They're following what's going on at the artist level. You got to watch what the artists are doing because any major artist starts using some new guitar, some new amplifier, whatever. Suddenly, you see a spike in sales because when I was a Steve Howe fanatic, I had dual Showman just like Steve Howe. I had a Gibson ES-175 just like Steve Howe. I had a Maestro Fuzz Bass. I had to have Steve's rig because I wanted his sound. And I didn't want to be any risk that I couldn't get his sound. So whatever. And Benny, you've lived this yourself, and you know it's just very, very common in the industry. So
I thought you were going to end this story with saying that you didn't sound like Steve Howe, regardless of the fact that you had a Showman and all the delay. Because here's what I did: like you could play through Eddie Van Halen's rig, and I'll play through it, and I'll tell you what it sounds like. Me, and that sucks.
I could get a pretty good Steve Howe sound. Oh God, I tried so hard to play.
It's in those Skeletor like hands. Like he is, like he literally is a crypt keeper. But he knows, like you see him, and now he comes out on stage. He's like Bob Barker's older brother, and he just comes out there, and he's literally a skeleton. And the ES-175 does not behoove him. Like it's literally ridiculous. But he plays, and you're like, how does this guy know? And I imagine he's one of those guys that has, if he had Alzheimer's, he could still play all the Yes catalog, but not know where he was because he just literally is so programmed to play these ridiculous things.
He's such a phenomenal guitar player. But you know, when I started down that path, I was like 17. You know, I didn't know I didn't have that talent. You know, I'm like, I'm going to give it everything I got, you know? And I worked really hard at it. And after 3 years, like, I improved. But it's like no, I'm not fit to wash his shoes, okay? And, you know, and so some people are that level. I mean, Steve Howe won Guitar Player of the Year. You know, the readers voted him number one. 5 years in a row. And then they created this rule that if you win 5 years in a row, you're retired. You can't run anymore. So then Steve Morse won 5 years in a row. It's like the Nunos. These people are just, they're like superhuman. And it's great. It's inspiring. It's a lot of people inspired, revved up to play. You know, Nuno says he heard Van Halen in 78. He's just, oh my God, what is this? Right. So Eddie, how many fucking players did Eddie create? You know, it's just like people just going, what? You know, so it's just one of the magic components of this industry.
Yeah. As someone who started off with that, the musical background, you know, throughout your career, how have you kept the music side of your life in parallel with that?
Very difficult. Very difficult. Yeah. When I left Boston, I advanced pretty quickly in the industry after that. Boston was like a learning thing. It didn't make any money, but a long learning thing. But, you know, going from Boston to Florida to Southern California, Oregon, back to Southern California, and then, you know, changing, I don't know how many studios I put together and then had to rip them apart and move. So it just got in the way. I just did not get to play. You know, we would have jams at my house. I keep my hand in it, but for a long time, I didn't get to play that much and certainly didn't get to record, songwriting, all that. I was doing a lot of writing in the late 80s, early 90s, and I didn't write anything until 2 years ago. So now I'm retired. So I'm talking to you from my rig right now. And so, you know, I'm in here every day, you know, and whether I'm writing or I'm just playing my guitar or tracking or mixing or studying about, you know, mixing. My God, what a rabbit hole that is. There's so many branches to it.
Corey's like, preach, dude.
Yeah.
But the career thing, you know, at post Boston, it became very difficult to keep my hands, you know, firmly in it. So,
are you excited now that you're retired that you can go back and do music? Because I feel it's like one. So first off, if you were playing Steve Howe, let's just start with, you're probably pretty damn good unless you're just delusional, because those songs are intense, man. Yeah.
Now,
what's it like now getting back on the saddle?
I don't have those chops anymore. I think something happens with your, you know, whatever, the hands and all that. I won't get those chops again, and I don't want to. It's not what I want to do. I want to do two things. I want to hang out with friends and play Beatles tunes and other songs from the 60s that we love. And I want to write and record stuff. So that's what I've been mostly doing. You know, I had my prog era. I loved it. I still love that stuff so much. You know, the Steve Howe, Bruford, Wakeman era, yes, Fragile and Close to the Edge, just like, still just astonishing, you know, it'll hold up forever. I got to see Genesis when Peter Gabriel was the lead singer. I saw him four times.
Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Like that's Genesis to me, not like Peter Gabriel, not Phil Collins coming out and hobbling, unable to play drums.
And Steve Hackett on guitar. And by the way, I saw Steve Hackett's touring, doing all this old Genesis stuff. So I'm in the L.A., one of the venues in LA about 3 years ago. And it was just like, it's stunning. So that era, that's why I say my brain, 65 to 75, so much of the stuff I love is, no, I grew up when Zeppelin hit, Hendrix hit, Cream hit. Like, I go back and go like, how did that happen? You know, it's like,
it's wild. Yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, artists who just set such a high bar. And it's so much fun to listen to. What was the question? Yeah.
Who knows? That's we're always.
I want to know what your new music sounds like. So it's, it sounds like you progressed from progressive. So now that you can't play like a Shredmaster, what you said you want to play like happy Beatles music, but what are you writing? What does the Gene Jolly original sound like?
Stuff has become more political, more personal, and I'm trying to think out of the box. Honestly, Chris Cornell inspired me with Euphoria Morning. Like, I don't want to write the same shit I used to write. I want to do different stuff. I want to talk. So one of the techniques I use is I'll just play and I'll just start freeforming on different riffs and all that. If something starts sounding good, I'll just record it on my iPhone and then I purposely won't listen to it for a month. And I have a bunch of that stuff. Then I go back and listen to it later. Because a month later, you'll know whether it's shit or not, right? Like in the moment, it can be good, but then it's not. So I start collecting those and a bunch of that stuff has ended up in songs. Sometimes two of those riffs end up in songs. So wow, this fits with that. Weird. And my weakest thing is lyrics. So I've been working a lot harder on lyrics. But I'm primarily interested in the craft of writing and recording music. And that's what I would have done had I realized, you know, when I realized I wasn't going to be Steve Howe, I have all this passion for music, I would have focused on that. Decent singer, but I think I have decent songwriting chops. I've been told by other people that I do. But that's a craft. You just need to practice it. You need to do it. You need to put the 10,000 hours in. And I have time now, you know, so I do it. And I have friends I collaborate with on it. And, you know, it's great. A lot of it's solo, but some of it's collaborative. And it's a big learning curve. So I don't have to rip my rig apart. Well, not true. I ripped apart my California rig to move to Boston. I'm now in an apartment in Linfield, and I will rip it apart again in January when we move to our new home up in Methuen, and that'll be it. My wife and I have a pact. One or both of us will die there. We are not moving again. All right. That is it. End of journey.
Yeah. So can I ask, did you choose to retire because you wanted to pursue kind of getting back into music, or can you talk about why you chose to do that, or...
I retired a year earlier. When I went to work for QSC, I made a 5-year commitment and I, at the end of about halfway through the fourth year, a couple things happened. First of all, I needed surgery on both of my feet. I get this plantar fasciitis and it's a long, boring thing, but incredibly painful.
Yeah.
And I need to do that. And then I had to go to a trade show and it was just in chronic pain. I'm in sales. I'm trying to be standing up, talking to dealers and so forth there. And it was just brutal. So that was happening. My grandkids, you know, my oldest grandchild turned 14. And you know, my wife and I looked at each other like this time is just going by so fast. So, and then the political situation, I decided to get heavily politically involved in the 2020 election. And I said, you know what? I can't do the job and devote what I want to do. There's these other things. And I would put it at the top of the list, take care of my health. Close behind is spend a lot more time with daughters and grandkids. And the third thing was political. Pretty closely clustered, though, that these are like three big priorities. So Joe Pham at QSC was cool about it. And he put a woman in charge of sales I was in charge of the Americas. And a woman who'd never been in charge of sales, but super talented, very accomplished in a number of other areas, said this would be a good portfolio growth thing for her. And so I got to spend 4 months with her, and she's just absolutely killing it in that position there. So it was a perfect transition. We didn't have to bring in someone from the outside who might or might not work out, but a superstar from the inside, and just expanded her portfolio. And I think it went extremely well. So I felt good. Yeah. I felt good leaving. Like, it's in, you know, Anna's, you know, going to take care of things, and she absolutely does. So
nice. Do you still have your toe in anything as, like, you know, on a consulting type of basis?
No. That's one rule I made is like, no. It's because then you completely violate all of the things you're talking. Like, it's not about the time you spend in the consulting work. It's the time your brain is engaged in trying to figure shit out. That's the shit that wakes me up at 2 a.m. That's the, like, no. Like, my brain has enough stuff. I need to discipline myself. No. Like, how many months have you been after me to do this? Okay. The only fucking reason I did this is because I like him. Okay? And I don't know why I like him. Okay?
We ask ourselves that question every day.
But he's funny. He's super talented. And he, you know, he's a cool guy. So I don't do this kind of thing because it's like, oh, I got to get out of my comfort zone. I got to fuck. I might say something wrong. I'm going to get canceled. I can't get canceled. I'm retired. Fuck you.
There's our episode title.
There's a really important question in that because, you know, as somebody whose brain never stops working, what's it like? Now you're retired. What wakes you up now? Because I can't imagine that your circadian rhythm just stops where you just go, okay, cool, I'm done with corporate life and doing this forever. Or do you just wake up and go, I can golf now? Like, is your brain still going? What's driving you now?
All right, so what you're really asking a question about intensity, right? And intensity doesn't change. You are who you are. You're wired how you wired. So I'm going to be intense until I die, right? This is the way it is, right? I'll be a slower version of intense, but I'll still be intense. And that's what I think. What wakes me up at 2 in the morning, and has for a long time, is the emerging civil war, okay? And this is where we're headed. And I used to think that was some people just overstating it and the boy crying wolf and all that. I don't think that anymore. I think there's too many guns. There's too much acrimony. I think January 6th was a dress rehearsal. And there's just too much crazy shit. And there's good people on the polar opposite of my perspective who like, would they shoot me? Or would they? It's like, I think they would, you know, given the right amount of, you know, remember, like, Nazi Germany was not Nazi Germany until Hitler won the election in 1933. And so he's suddenly shutting down the media. He's destroying the courts. It's a one-party thing. And before you know it, the brown shirts on the street, Kristallnacht is going on. And, you know, the rest is history.
That right? didn't happen.
Right. Exactly. That's what we have.
Everyone's a Kristallnacht? Hold on. Listen, I really want to ask, for real, because Corey is hyper-intelligent. And Siobhan, she's like a show-winning horse. She knows everything. Do you know what Kristallnacht is?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course? So you say, of course. Corey, do you know what Kristallnacht was? Okay, because I feel like that what they teach in schools nowadays, like I know my 16-year-old that lives in my house absolutely has no idea anything about that because they don't teach it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I went to a very progressive like art school that had a lot of Jewish people. So, I think probably the education I got was a little bit, you know, not your standard American public school.
And by the way, if anyone was conflating the fact that I was being sarcastic about the Holocaust actually happening and all the precipitating factors, I'm joking. It's sarcasm because I want to be clear that Kristallnacht, for example, is something where in one night a whole area was just completely just taken apart by people in hatred because somebody was so smart they were able to control them all mentally. They became so divisive. It was people, friends against friends just because they were a religion. It was out of control. And it happened in one night. They fucking raided the town. They pillaged, they raped, they lit things on fire, they broke stuff, stole art.
Well, the word came from smashing the windows, right?
Correct.
Was, yeah.
It's Night of the Broken Glass, right? So
yeah.
But you say it happened in one night, but it was 4 years building. Shutting down institutions and basically getting the propaganda out there that these are vermin, you know, Jews are vermin and they must be exterminated and so on and so forth. And so when you start turning people into vermin and scum of the earth and so on and so forth, you're setting the stage. And this is how one side is talking about the other right now. It's like, you know, so that's what I'm saying. It's like, I used to think people were being overdramatic and so on and so forth. Can't happen here and all that. And I'm sure a lot of people in Germany thought the same thing there. Now, you know, we didn't have the destitute economic condition. We don't have the destitute economic condition that the Germans had, which made, you know, Germany ripe for those conditions there. So you have to be careful not to get. But when I look at the amount of guns in the hands of the citizenry, when I look at social media, I look at talk radio, Fox News, and so on and so forth are doing to create a parallel universe that has, you know, tens of millions of people, you know, totally bought into, you know what, I think we need a fucking revolution. then, you know, that's the shit that wakes me up at 10 in the morning. You know, that stuff right now is, it's just nutty.
You know what's crazy is that if you go to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, which is the hand of God, or it's the Holocaust Museum, there's a big saying, well, a quote that on the wall from Heinrich Heine in 1820, that where books are burned, human beings are also destined to be burned. And even though that's a 201-year-old quote, the same like mentality still exists, even with cancel culture, because we're literally just burning the books. That's exactly what we're doing. Like, there are people that are saying you can't read To Kill a Mockingbird because they use the N-word, or you can't read all these classic, Gone with the Wind, for fuck's sake, that's racist. Obviously it's racist. It's supposed to be about racism because it was in a racist time. Like, what the fuck?
A story about racism is not racism. And anybody in the room who's saying it's racism knows damn well it's not racism. Telling a story about racism is not racism. It's exposing it, okay? It's telling the story. It's showing what happened. Mm-hmm. It's insanity.
Yeah, you referred to the emerging civil war, and I guess how do you feel in terms of social media and the media in general being a magnifying glass on a microcosm type of situation, as opposed to what's, you know, it's a big country, you know, hundreds and millions of people. You only see a small piece of that through the media. I guess how far along that emergence do you see things right now?
I mean, I'm listening to this woman from Facebook who's testifying every day on what she knows about what Facebook knows on the inside. There's this big rebellion brewing inside Facebook. All the employees are going, we're a horrible company. We're doing terrible things to America in the name of profit. You know, they don't want to change the algorithms because it's going to reduce their revenue and profitability in the stock price. You know, it's really that simple. So U.S. government needs to regulate this sort of business here. The government has regulated businesses going back over a century when they get too powerful and or corrupt and or, you know, fill in the blank. But this is a very unusual situation here where a company like that with 2 billion users, and many of whom are active on a daily basis, learns how to manipulate the likes and the dislikes, you know, the angers and the likes and all that. And they know how to get things accelerated into polarization. And so I'm not blaming them for all of it. There's no way they're responsible for all of it.
I blame the death of Nate Dogg because he's not around to regulate anymore with Warren G. Did you catch that one?
I don't know what they're talking about. Right,
no, so. There's a song called Regulators from the 90s with it's Nate Dogg and Warren G. And Nate Dogg, may his soul, we miss him.
Yes, thank you for that contribution.
You're welcome.
I would miss him if I knew who he was.
No, I knew you wouldn't get that one, but it was just funny because there are going to be people that go, wow, he went deep.
Leave it to Beaver at you, all right? I deserve that.
Yeah, I was going to say, leave it to Beaver. Why don't you talk about Dennis the Menace, dude? Or like maybe like Looney Tunes. Like, can we talk about that? Or how about Tech Avery era Tom and Jerry? That's some crazy ass shit, dude. If you watch like those 1940s, 1950s Tom and Jerry shit, like that's definitely racist and some crazy ass Nostradamus bullshit that like, wow. Like, they don't show it anymore because, well, I mean, even if you talk about the Looney Tunes, like, you can't have Speedy Gonzalez. You can't have Pepe Le Pew. Like, that's not okay. He's going around smelling like shit trying to rape everybody. Like, that's not okay anymore. Apparently. But it was cool for a while.
Oh, my God.
I don't know where I was going with that, but I liked Pepe Le Pew. He had a cool thing going.
Well, yeah. I mean, coming back to social media, yeah. Even as a bystander on Facebook, right? I'm pretty surprised on a daily basis with the vitriol that I find there and only
good
there.
Word.
You know, the how people get very worked up and very angry about stuff very quickly. So it's wild. I mean, it's scary. I totally agree. The way people talk to each other.
But don't you
know?
Think it's like an exponential level of yellow journalism, Siobhan? Because like I feel like the whole concept of yellow journalism or like whisper campaigns. Like it's like basically like whisper campaigns, except there's just exponentially more, and all the fucking crazy Looney Tunes could be like, there are other crazy Looney Tunes that believe the earth is flat and that there's fucking dinosaurs concurrent to human beings. Holy shit, there's someone like me. And there's groups and there's thousands of them. And it's like a whisper campaign. And that's what you're seeing on Facebook, because it's like, you know, they're posting a meme and they don't realize the meme is like, it means something deeper than their brain can even handle.
I would also say, and in my experience, about 80 to 90% of the people that are super passionate on social media about their cause, if you talk to them in person, that falls away immediately. And so this is why I'm saying, and I've said this on the show before, we are incredibly ill-equipped to be a political discussion show, but as far as like the actual intercommunication thing,
are you telling us to shut the fuck up on this issue?
Not at all. I just want to make sure the audience knows that at least I am very stupid, so anything I say, take with a grain of salt.
You're actually right. People are paper tiger. You know, online, they're all vitriolic, and you get like in the bar, it's a complete vibe. Okay.
Yeah.
So that is definitely dynamic.
I have friends that are on the opposite end of the political spectrum that post some very, you know, post those memes and those statements that they forward with much conviction. And then, like you said, you sit at a bar and I go, like really? And like, well, not like that, but, you know, I kind of feel that. And then it's like, I think people need to, you know, hash it out a little more. It's, you know, it's like the YouTube comment section. No one would say half the shit they say if they were worried about getting punched in the face.
But I think that, like, we're really in a good place, though, as far as we could say it, we could put it out there, and if people want to agree, they can either share it or they could turn it off, which is a really cool yet terrifying exponential concept, you know, because now everyone has the stage, and it's just a matter of which stage you want to look at. And so now the playing field is leveled, whereas you used to have television and you had radio and you had a newspaper. Now anybody can go live stream a fucking crime or shooting someone, or and it's all happening probably right now. And that's the crazy thing, is you who even knows like what's going on next? It's scary.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. Well, how do we get back to what was the topic at hand?
I did have a note from the first episode that I wanted to jump back to, because I saw a little bit of passion sneaking out of Eugene when you mentioned thieves. You know, as a retail, you know, empire, they're going, was theft such a big part of what you had to deal with that it warrants that reaction?
The unfortunately, the worst problem is employees, and some of the worst times of my life were finding out that somebody had ripped us off. You know, we pick a physical inventory and find out there were four Sony DAT machines worth $2,000, you know, each, missing, along with, you know, Lexicon reverbs and blah blah. Hire an investigator, figure out what it is, and it's just like, you know, it's just stab in the back kind of stuff there. So the shoplifter, when you remember when Worlds was on Newbury Street, right, Benny? Right. So I used to chase people down, you know, Mass Ave, just come in and grab a guitar, run down the street, whatever. Usually unsuccessfully retrieving the guitar. But you know, you have that sort of stuff there, and there's ways to manage that, but really more internal theft was the more the heartbreaking, frustrating, you know, part. Because usually, it's, you know, you're working shoulder to shoulder, you know, so usually it's this fraternity, sorority thing, and then somebody's ripping you off. So that's the worst.
Yeah. Was that something that was considered even, you know, or at least discussed when you were at the higher levels in companies?
Oh, yeah. This Guitar Center has loss prevention department, you know, to deal with that. And all big retailers do. Because it's just, if you're not constantly figuring out what the latest thing is and have ways to manage it, you will get eaten alive. It's the real world.
Yeah. No, I remember when I was growing up, my mom used to talk about the store that she ran, and she did like high fashion women's retail. But that's the same thing she mentioned, was the hardest part for her as a small business was when she had to leave town to go on a buying trip, and people, it was employees that were mostly stealing, you know, it was not really the people outside that were taking stuff, but, you know, coming back and realizing stuff was missing. So it's interesting to think about when you have to scale up your business and you're, you know, having multiple stores across various regions of a giant country, having to deal with that sort of thing, and who can you trust and how do you manage that, you know?
Yeah, GC put a cycle counting protocol in place after they started expanding after going public in the 90s, and theft was a huge problem, the CEO promoted an employee named Laura Taylor, who built a whole operations loss prevention infrastructure in there. And part of that was cycle counting portions of the inventory every week. So you wouldn't go a whole year taking a physical to find out you were missing a lot of stuff. And it was also very beneficial making sure the stores were replenished properly, because if the computer said 11, you only had three, that's a problem. You're going to run out. And, well, what do you mean? We have eight in stock. No, those are all ripped off. So so there's ways that you can use technology / manpower to help manage the situation there, but it must be managed. You cannot just hope is not a strategy for handling for doing loss prevention. You've got to have processes and personnel to handle it.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about if you are someone that maybe wants to open up a small retail store, like a small music shop or a guitar store or something with music equipment, is that something that you think is a feasible idea now, you know, dealing with all these big, massive companies where you can order stuff online? I mean, is that something that people can sustain? And what sort of advice would you give to someone that maybe has that idea of opening up a smaller, privately owned shop?
Grant Sheffield left Guitar Center 2016, not of his own volition. It was after Aries took over, and they made some personnel cuts. So here's a veteran regional vice president, 25 plus years with the company. So he opened his own shop in Dallas called Tone Shop. It's been done so well, he just opened a second shop a few months ago, right? And I see this all over the country. So if you are a go-getter, if you're passionate about musical gear, if you like talking to people, you give a fair deal, it's a great industry. It continues to expand. The global financial crisis was a big exception, but since the Beatles, I mean, this industry just grown and grown and grown and grown and grown. It's a wonderful thing. I think the more we have the more guitars to offset guns, it's a good thing.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think guitars are an investment? Like, do you think, because I always tell people, and I full-heartedly believe this, that my guitar collection is my 401k I get to play. And people make fun of it, but I have literally, like, on paper, made a whole shit ton of money if I were to sell. That's not an investment if you don't sell. Yeah. But do you think that, like, people talk about it, but, like, do you consider buying guitars at this point if you know what you're doing an investment? Or is it like Bitcoin, where it's like a total gamble, but still apparently an investment?
I consider Bitcoin more of an investment than a guitar, okay? Bitcoin, you know, if you understand the mathematics behind Bitcoin, if you buy a small amount of Bitcoin now and you hold it for 10, 20 years, the likelihood it'll be worth, you know, many times more than you pay for it is pretty good now, okay? And it's been a long road to get here, okay? And I don't want to get off on that. I have very limited expertise on that. Guitars can be an investment, Benny, but you have to become what you are. You have to become an expert on all the years, the models, the pickup configurations, so on and so forth there, that most people don't have the interest or the time to really dive into. So unless you're willing to become one of those people who's astute enough to really understand what the hell it is you're buying and, you know, the past, present, and future of that guitar, I don't recommend it. You know, but some people I know are into it, you're one of them, and have done very well with it. Elliot Rubinson, that I worked for at Thoroughbred, was a big collector and had a lot of great stuff that over the years he told me how much he paid for it in 1970. I went to work for him in 1996, and it's worth like literally 15 times what he paid for it, right? So that's a great investment. But that's very specialized, and so it's not for the average person.
It's, well, Brian, my brother, my twin brother, calls me the truffle pig, which I think is a very accurate metaphor, because amongst the shit, I find the fungi that cost a lot.
Is that your new credit at the end of the episode, the truffle pig?
Yeah, I don't know.
Actually,
I don't even remember.
That's a good one, Corey. Add that to the queue of stupid things that I do.
With pleasure.
Thanks, man.
Well, I don't know how to get back to where we were before, so Ben derailed us.
One word at a time, Siobhan. One word at a time. It's a long road. Just remember that Joe Walsh will never guide you wrong.
Correct.
She's like, I don't know who that is. Canceled. Canceled. Life wasn't good for her. Do you know who Joe Walsh is?
Yeah.
I know the name. Am I embarrassing myself?
No, it's great. It's adorable. You're literally adorable for not knowing who Joe Walsh is. But like,
you have years of discovery of Joe Walsh ahead of you.
Okay. Okay, I'm looking.
See, the
right
thing
now.
Is, but I'm the inverse. So, like, where you're discovering the new music, I'm discovering like Dvork and like other Bach. Like, there's more than one Bach. There's 10 Bachs, and some of them are good. Like, I love, like, Siobhan has actually turned me on to a bunch of classical music because I feel like that other than jazz, which is just like musical surprise.
Did you have like 16 children or something?
Who? Sorry.
Yeah, a lot.
Bach and Bach have like 16 children.
Oh yeah. And they were all with like different people too, I'm sure.
Nine were composers, right? Or somewhere. It's like, it's think about that.
It's wild. Yeah. What different era. Yeah. The rock stars of the 1600s.
Exactly.
So what are your plans, you know, moving forward with retirement? You're getting a new place. Like, is it just to keep writing and, you know, enjoying the music side that you've had to put on hold?
Yeah, the main reason we moved back to Boston, we love Southern California. We have a lot of great friends there. It was hard, you know, making that move.
Beautiful out there, man. Beautiful.
But, there's everything about it. And it's a very expansive state. You know, the mindset is progressive and it's open and, you know, it's just everything about it we love. So we tore ourselves away from there. We're here because our daughters and grandkids are here, and we get a lot of family and friends here as well. But you know, it's just like we made the move for daughters and grandkids primarily. And while we're here, we're just, you know, retirement is not slowing down; it's just shifting, you know, focus. So music has been my love since the Beatles, and so I'll play around with that. I'm a birder. I'm into birds. About 5-6 years ago, I got into bird photography, so I'm learning that. It's a cool new thing. You know, I didn't know shit from Shinola about using a camera, but I get...
It's just a triangle.
I get decent with a Canon PowerShot, so a year ago, I bought a nice rig, Canon EOS 90D with a Sigma 150 600 millimeter lens.
Just make sure that there's as much bokeh as you could possibly have, so you look artistic and only like one little bit is in total focus, and it makes you seem profound. I've learned that.
Yes.
People don't know that. That's a trick.
I've learned that.
Corey's just laughing so hard. He's like, "Is that the only thing you can come up with?"
Yeah. So golf is something I enjoy with friends, and it's an incredibly difficult thing. Hardest thing I ever tried to learn. It's like guitar, you get to a certain level and you're at that level. Golf, you think you're at a level and then you find out, no asshole, you still suck. And you just fall off that level and now you...
What's that dude's name?
Wow.
Who's been ruling golf since the dawn of time? Like, isn't there just one dude that like literally, like everyone's like Michael Jordan or LeBron, like, and there's this
like
dude
Tiger
in golf.
Woods?
No, way more than him. What's you know who I'm talking about? He just always wins. Everything is just that one dude in golf.
Tiger Woods.
I just don't care about golf
that's
at all.
Thought.
So, like, other than Alice Cooper, like, that's pretty much where my golf
the last 20
ends.
Years has been Tiger Woods. We don't want to play golf again. He got into a bad car accident. Many months ago.
Not Tiger.
Screwed up his leg. Yeah, he did. But yeah, he's a phenom. He's the two greatest golfers in my lifetime are Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods.
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking about tennis. It's Federer or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Different sport,
yeah. I crossed my wire. That's how little I care about sports as a whole.
Yeah.
I literally am so disenchanted with sports that I can't even seriously make a joke because I'm thinking about Michael Jordan playing baseball. And he did, but like, not. It's not really a thing.
Yeah. They all have balls. Okay, so I see the confusion.
Yeah, just don't be Ted Williams.
Anyways, question?
Yeah, no, it was just kind of seeing, you know, what your plans were. But I guess a good place to leave off our last 15 minutes here is, you know, throughout your career, if you could maybe impart some wisdom on our viewers and listeners, you know, to those that want to get into the same space that you were in, you know, the retail merchandising and that, and then maybe do want to actually try to climb that ladder and have that influence and
are you asking him to consult?
for the moment.
Briefly for the moment.
Briefly, you know some
sort of catharsis. Just catharsis. Okay. Is that okay, Gene? Can we ask you like through cathartically?
I think you're talking about osmosis, not catharsis.
It's transcendental, right?
Forget it.
Transcendental. So I don't recommend my career path to anybody because it was completely unique. And some of it just happened. And it was just, you know, I mean, I fell madly in love with somebody when I was 21 and we get married and started a family. And I took a complete left turn. And I was working in a music store, and you know, when you look at it, like, that's not a business plan. It was a combination of love and persistence and good fortune and super hard work. I mean, so one advice: work your ass off. Okay, I don't care whether you start your own store, whether you go to work for another company, whatever. You want to go places, you got to work hard. And anybody who tells you work life balance, forget it. There's no work life balance for any meaningful period of time, at least in your formative years. You've got to pay your dues, you got to work hard, and you got to learn, apply yourself, right? And I would say the other one is like, work with good people, you know, because whether it's the boss or the people you're working with and all that there, you know, first of all, it's more fun, you learn. When I say good people, not just like good as in, you know, a charity, I mean good people, you know, kind people, smart people, collaborative people, people that you're like working with every day and you're going to learn from and you're going to grow. You know, it's a whole, you know, collaboration thing I was talking about before. Like, you get ideas, you bounce things off people, they bounce things off you, and just like your brain grows, you know, and your skills grow. And it's just like the days go by like that because you're with your people. So, I guess another way of saying that is you get into a bad situation. Sometimes you get to stick it out for a while, but you know, you don't want to do it for too long. You want to get into a better situation. And sometimes that it's going to mean, you know, maybe moving back home for a while or whatever, but work with good people.
On that note about the situations, you know, you mentioned that you've uprooted and moved, you know, around multiple times through your career. Were there any times where that was either a difficult decision or was it all just the opportunity that came up?
I spent almost half my career in Boston. And then first half of my career, roughly in Boston, and the second half, you know, primarily on the West Coast. So I left Boston in 96 and retired in 2000. I should know this off the top of my head. So what, that's 24 years. I had a 45 year career. So the second half of my career was the moving part. Boston to Florida to Southern Cal to Oregon to back. And every one of those things was a move up, was a move up, was a move up, was a move up. A bigger opportunity, growth opportunity and all that. And it's hard doing it. My poor wife had to engineer every one of these moves. You're ripping your studio apart. She's ripping her cult studio apart. You're having to disconnect from friends. You have to find all new doctors and at banks. Mm-hmm. It's just a colossal thing. And it's just a price you pay, you know, to get the opportunity. And it's difficult. It's part of that working your ass off thing. And if you refuse to do things that are inconvenient, I'm sorry. There's just things that are going to come along that you're not going to be able to do, you know. So, and sometimes that's fine. You know, there's a bunch of opportunities I turned down. And over time, I felt I made the right decisions because it was mostly because I had unease about the person. Or, you know, like the company who was talking to me and or, you know, the culture, there was just something about it. Like, I'm not sold. This could be a big step backwards. I'm not doing this.
I'm going to give you my James Lipton question. Charles Bukowski said, find what you love and let it kill you. How does that make you feel?
You know what? I think it's too much on this find what you love thing. Find what you're good at, right? Because if you're good at it, you will love it, all right? Because here's the problem with finding what you love, okay? If I had my way, I would have been the next Steve Howe, okay? I didn't have anywhere near the talent to become the next Steve Howe or anybody like him, okay? So find your love is a stupid piece of advice if you're not fucking wired to do what you love. And what if you're only a teenager and, you know, you love, you know, I could go on about all the different examples, right? But if you can find what you're good at, it's kind of fun to be good at something, you know, and people will pay you for it and you get accolades and promotions and shit like that. It's just like, oh, I kind of like being good at things, you know? And so just find out what, and like, I didn't know I was going to be good at retail. I was like, hey, no, I like, but my drummer's like, can you run the warehouse? Like, what? I want to do that. And so, and then, but then it led to, you know, being able to be on the sales floor and like, and then my boss said, hey, this guy's get some skills. And they, so then he lets me, my first merchandising thing, junior in charge of microphones and effects pedals, you know, in the late 70s, Benny, right? That's a pretty cool time to be charged of. I'm buying
Tom Schultz coming in. I'm telling you what's up.
I got a photo of Tom Schultz handing me the first power show, you know, before he did the Rockman, right? It's just like I'm in like magic land, you know? So anyways, the find what you love thing is a little dangerous because there's just too many. It's really more about find what you good at.
So my James Lipton response to that is, so basically what you're saying is find what you're good at and let that kill you.
Such no, a nihilist.
Kill you.
There was a great message there and you ruined it.
Let things kill you. Letting things kill you is not good advice. Do not.
Right, exactly.
But you know, there's
Nietzsche disagrees.
There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong to pushing yourself beyond your limit and finding out, okay, that's beyond my limit and then dialing back. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's just like, are you guys aware of a professor named Scott Galloway from NYU Stern School of Business? Okay. So he's all over. He has multiple podcasts. He sends out really good email. Just look him up. Scott Galloway. Write it down. Okay.
I've seen him before. Yeah.
Scott clarified for me several years ago the whole bullshit about, you know, find what you love, and gets more. And he very way more eloquently than me goes down the whole path of find what you're good at. And I think it's a message that, you know, we need to be repeating.
Do you think it's because it's, you know, any of those like cliches that are boiled down to oversimplified, you know, don't really hold up to scrutiny? Because you could say that, you know, I guess, you know, a lot of people, maybe if they're open to being tangentially related to what they love, they can find opportunities and follow those paths. You know, you know, because you were technically not doing the music, but you were in the musical element and you got to meet people that were musicians and hang out with them. So you were still somewhat in that range.
Not really. I consider serving musicians instead of being a musician. Very, very different. Okay. And what allowed me to serve musicians was not my being a musician. It was my being organized, having a head for business, choosing to do the work, to go to school, to have all the courses and so on and so forth there. And the fact that I'm serving musicians and talking to the people who were simpatico, we have a lot of the same loves and interests and all that, was just like so freaking cool. I wasn't a retailer selling appliances, you know, or hardware. I was selling musical instruments. So that's where I came from. So I got lucky that way. I got to work my entire career in the music industry. But working serving musicians, whether it's on the manufacturing or the retail side, completely different career than being a musician. Listen to Nuno's stories. That's being a musician, okay? Mm-hmm. Sleeping in the fucking rehearsal space, on the fucking, you know, cases, you know, with rats, and having the money. And when Burger King comes up with a $2 for $1 thing, it's this, you know, this gift from heaven. You know, it's just like being poor, taking the vow of poverty, like, and just like, whatever. That's, you know, and I don't know how many musicians I know who just like, they really, really gave up so much to get to the certain level there. And most of them didn't make it, okay? Most of them didn't make it. So tell that story, okay? Do what you love, okay? Well, do what you love, but just be prepared to have, you know, the fucking concrete smashed into your face, you know, at the end of a decade of putting all that stuff into it, you know? But know, just know that, like, dude, I'm willing to make that, all right? I'm going to do that. I want to give it all I got. And don't be 30 going, you know, God damn it, I wish I had given all I got. Well, while you can, do it all you got. But don't pretend, you know, you're guaranteed to make it at the other end because of this small percentage, right? So I didn't be a musician. I served musicians. No regrets. I did it because I was at a point in time where I knew I wasn't going to be Steve Howe. I knew I was madly in love with my wife of 46 years. And I was the oldest of 8 kids. She was the oldest of 6. We wanted to raise a family, and we went down that path fast. And I was fortunate. I had something I could pay the bills with, you know, and it was interesting. You know, and I could grow it. That was just fortune, good fortune. You know, hard work, but also good fortune.
Yeah, what an amazing journey you've had. It's so great to hear from you, and you have great advice. And like, wow, I don't even know how to summarize it.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you taking your time.
I'm glad to have you dumbfounded.
Well, I love this because again,
myself.
So everybody knows that NAMM is a place where people go to showboat in this industry, and I got to tell you, I've seen Michelangelo Badio, I've seen Jeff Loomis, I've seen John Petrucci, I've seen Paul Reed Smith, and I got to say, when I first met Gene Jolly, I've never seen a dude with more reverence around him, with people just like, oh, that's him, that's the guy. Like, I swear, like, we had to, like, swim through the crowd to get to Gene. And, like, he has a demeanor that, like, when you're at NAMM, which, by the way, it sounds like NAMM, like Vietnam, because there's, like, fucking drummers all playing drum circles simultaneously as guitars are all playing guitars simultaneously through loud amps and synthesizers. And then Gene's just yelling and people are just all trying to soak it in. So I just want to say thank you, Gene, for coming on. For getting me my first set of QSC K12.2s that have served me righteously, and for just being such an illuminating person where we don't understand a lot of this stuff, especially being on the other end of the mirror. So it's pretty cool, man. Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun, and never again. But
back to Kristallnacht.
Never
again. Never again!
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, with that, you've been 2020.
Somehow we did.
Yeah, oh my God.
No, really.
020-D.com.
Subscribe, please.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 73, featuring Elizabeth Jaroff, the charismatic voice. Check it out.
Essentially, instead of me saying what people should know about, I need to go ask people what they want to know about. Say, what can I do for you? Not what do I think you need, but what do you want? And then take whatever it is that people are wanting. If they're wanting reaction videos, okay, well, how can I make those reaction videos give a twist to it and make it something that I really value, which is musical appreciation and vocal appreciation? And so the first one I did was a breakdown of a bunch of Fifth Element diva dance singers. And I said, okay, well, this is like how they're doing it. And this is what they did here. And this is why this one's so cool. And this one's so cool in this way. And then that's when it started the ball rolling. So I think like a really big blocker to a lot of people is putting out content that they say, everyone should love this. And instead sort of turning around and saying, what is trending? And how can I make that something that is unique to me?
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.